Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. On today's show, actor Wes Studi talks about the new film Hostiles. Mitchell Cushman talks about staging Jez Butterworth's 3-hour, 14-person epic play, Jerusalem, and Danielle Duval talks about her new album, Lose It. That's all coming up on today's show. That was Danielle Duval with the song Undercover off her new album, Lose It. And you'll hear from Danielle a little later on. My first guest is one of cinema's most celebrated First Nations Native American actors. He has appeared in such films as Dances with Wolves, Last of the Mohicans, Geronimo, The New World, Street Fighter, Heat, Mystery Men, Avatar, A Million Ways to Die in the West, and television series such as Penny Dreadful. He is now in a new film where he plays a dying Cheyenne chief in 1892. written by and directed by Scott Cooper. He stars with Christian Bale, Rosamund Pike, Ben Foster, Stephen Lang, Jesse Plemons, Rory Cochran, Adam Beach, Koryanka Kilcher, and 2017 cinema darling, Timothy Chalamet. He is Wes Studi, and I talked with him late last week. Here is me and Wes Studi talking about Hostiles. Some say that the Western genre is a dying art form, and yet we're starting to see it come back a little bit. What do you make of where it's at right now?
All right. Well, I think I simply said that I disagreed with you in terms of the Western becoming a dying form. The Western itself may have changed periods in terms of moving off into outer space and or other action films territories, but you know, the form itself is alive and well, and what we did with Hostiles is simply put it back in its original time frame. And that's Hostiles for you. It was a manuscript probably written in, I think, it was, probably the 60s by a writer. I believe his last name is Stewart. I can't think of his first name right now. But Scott Cooper then took the manuscript and made a working screenplay of it. And that's what we have with Hostiles.
I've heard you state in the past that the Western genre was always sort of your bread and butter as a Native American actor. What was it about, or is it about that type of film that is so conducive for Native American characters and actors?
Well, the Native American characters have always been a part of at least in different amounts of importance to Western stories over the years, that yes, it has been more or less my bread and butter in that I was available to do Westerns mainly because of image, right? I mean, if you want to use Native Americans in your story, then use actual Native American actors. It's, you know, provides much more authenticity to your stories, to your pictures, and hopefully you have some good Native American actors to do the roles. So yeah, it's like I said, it's probably the easiest portal for Native Americans to enter the world of acting in movies.
On that note, where do you think we are today in terms of Native American representation in film and in media?
I believe we're in a growing state. You know, we've only been involved in movies in terms of actually being recognized as actors since about the time of, say, the outlaw Josie Wales in the 70s, with actors such as Jay Silverheels and Chief Dan George and the late Will Sampson, who made quite an imprint and with their portrayals of Native American characters and stories from that time. Before that, you know, we had always been usually a definite part of many Westerns as the antagonists of one kind or another, which you know, glorified the militaries or the cowboys of that time in terms of fighting off the Indians or something like that. As time went on, we began to flesh out these characters in the roles played by these particular actors that I just named a few minutes ago. And the Western kind of comes and goes in its particular time space in terms of, you know, going back into the 1890s, 1860s, 90s, which is the era of the Wild, Wild West, if you will. So we've been an integral part of actually the whole industry of movie making in terms of we as Native Americans have been subjects probably from the very one of the first films ever even done by, was it Edison or Curtis, who, you know, shot very short films that the subject matter was entirely Native Americans, like out here at these pueblos in New Mexico and other places. But modern day involvement by Native Americans, I think, really started, like I said, back in the late 60s, 70s with these particular films that I mentioned earlier. Then they went to rest for a good long while, then came back in the late 80s and 90s. Another surge of a lot of films that included Native American characters in their stories. And then again went to sleep for a while until just a few years ago. At this point, culminating with our film *Hostiles*.
Now, you play a Cheyenne chief in this film, and you actually have to speak a lot of the Cheyenne language. What challenges does performing dialogue in another language? How do you go about doing that as an actor?
Well, we work with people who actually speak the languages. They consult with us and they teach us how to speak the phonetics of a language. While we don't totally understand what we're saying, we do have the advice of language consultants that add to our understanding of what is said in any particular sentence that's put together in a script. While we essentially must feel what we say, we have to know, you know, which parts to emphasize and which parts to play down, or even throwaway lines or such. But we're taught very effectively by good teachers of the language in that our ultimate test is, of course, if the people who actually speak the language can understand us. So we do have to work very hard at doing that.
Scott Cooper, the director, was very adamant about making this film as authentic as possible. And you've talked about that in the past, about that was one of the things that worked for this movie. Did you have any conversations with either him or Christian Bale about the time period and, you know, certain things that would make the film more authentic?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, we, along with, like we say, our Cheyenne consultants, we worked with them in collusion, if you will, in terms of putting together the right way to portray any particular scene. Sure.
Now, the film takes place in 1892, but I know you guys shot it in the summer and the fall of 2016. Do you see any parallels, you know, between sort of culture and race relations between the era of your film and what we're seeing now in the States?
I believe that's a commonly held or commonly asked question, actually, because the film does point out discrepancies in what we do and what we say we do. I think it is a good reflection of the kind of world we find ourselves in today. I think it also offers sort of a solution if one is ready to consider it.
You know, up here in Canada, the last few years, there's been a lot of dialogue between the government and Indigenous groups, you know, the Reconciliation Project and all that. On the larger scale, culturally and socially, where do you think we are in terms of dialogue between those communities?
Well, again, I would say that you know, I think we've heard good talk from, say, the Canadian governments and how that talk is passed, how that talk is actually backed up by action is still yet something to come or something to hopefully look forward to. You know, I can appreciate the fact that the Canadian government has acknowledged and apologized for its role in terms of a damn near genocide of First Nations people up there. That that I see as a step in the right direction and something that the United States itself has never even considered doing, but. On the other hand, it all amounts to does the government walk the talk, or you know, are they really going to do? Are they really up to doing something about what's going on?
Now I know you're a big fan of comedy. Obviously, people might remember you from Mystery Men, but I read in an interview somewhere that one of your big dreams is to do sort of an old codger curmudgeon comedy in the style of Morgan Freeman. Any news? Is that going to be in your future?
It's in the works.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Now I know you have a couple other projects coming out this year. One that intrigues me is called The Pipeline, which I understand is based on true stories surrounding the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline. Do you know when that film's going to be released? Can you tell us anything about that?
I can't tell you a whole lot about it, as I don't know exactly what the development stage is at this point. I know that it's a darn good story, and like you said, it does it takes its information from the Alaska oil pipeline and the effects it had upon not only the environment but individuals that were deeply involved in the whole gold rush, if you will, oil rush, maybe. Yeah, I think it's a wonderful story, and we're looking forward to it being able to be released in theaters as soon as it's ready.
And you said, I think I read somewhere that you said you long for the day where, as actors, you're not sort of labeled as a Native American actor or this type of actor, but you just want to be an actor. How close do you think we are to achieving that or recognizing that?
Well, I think that it's unfortunately kind of a come and go thing. You mentioned Mystery Men, and then there's another film called Deep Rising that we're in. Actually, a number of films that I've been able to do that didn't necessarily call for a Native American character, but the fact that I am Native American would essentially make that character Native American, right? But I think that we all strive to be known as actors rather than any particular whatever our nationality is, our race is. It's a matter of being recognized as an all-around actor, rather than being pigeonholed into one kind of actor or another.
Well, the film is Hostiles, and it's in theaters in wide release starting today. Wes Studi, thanks so much for your time today.
Hey, it's been a pleasure.
Alrighty, take care. Cheers.
Okay, cheers.
That was my conversation with Wes Studi. His new film, Hostiles, is out now. Here is Danielle Duval with Subway Wall. That was Danielle Duval with Subway Wall. In 2009, my guest co-founded the theater company Outside the March. Outside the March is dedicated to pioneering work that is immersive, sight-engaging, new, wide-reaching, and communal. And over the past 8 years, they have become one of Canada's leading immersive theater companies, inviting audiences to play with us in kindergarten classrooms, parade with Queen Elizabeth along the Danforth, tinker in garages, congregate in churches, venture out on a 911 paramedic call, weather the apocalypse in an abandoned movie theater, infuse an old funeral home with love, and join them up on stage at the Royal Alexandra Theater. Their newest show is called Jerusalem. Jerusalem is written by a great modern British playwright, Jez Butterworth, and was originally staged back in 2010 with Academy Award-winning actor Mark Rylance, though it was before he actually won the award. Outside the March teamed up with the company theater to bring it to Canada, and it goes up next month as Canada's premiere, and it stars one of Canada's finest actors, Kim Coates, who audiences may remember from his turn on Sons of Anarchy. The director of the show is the co-artistic director of Outside the March and the co-founder, Mitchell Cushman, and I spoke with him just a few days ago about the project. Mitchell Cushman, hello.
Hey.
How are you doing today?
Great, how are you doing?
Good. So you showed me this set just before we started.
I did, yes.
There's a big trailer. The process of getting something like that, not only into the rehearsal space, but then disassembling it and remounting it in the performance phase, how tricky is that to navigate sometimes?
So, the center of this play is this Airstream trailer that the main character, Johnny Rooster Byron, who's a aging daredevil, lives in the English forest. He's squatting in this trailer. So we knew we needed to find that before anything else. And the set designer, Nick Blay, and myself, we found really amazing one on Kijiji. So we drove to Hamilton and we bought this thing together. It kind of felt like we were married. Like we went out and bought this trailer. That was about 6 months ago. So then we had to find somewhere to store it and everything else. But we're doing the show in the brand new Crow's Theater building, which is a beautiful space, really high ceilings. But the one problem is that the loading door is not very big. So we had to cut this beautiful trailer into 5 or 6 pieces in order to get it in. So that meant also we were able to have it in the rehearsal hall too, which I never thought we'd be able to get it in there, but it makes a big difference because it really is like one of the characters in the show.
The play is Jerusalem, written by Jez Butterworth, and this is the Canadian premiere of it. Does that hold a special significance for you?
Well, I run Outside the March, which is one of the two companies producing the show along with Company Theatre, and part of our mandate is to either produce new work or work that is at least new to Canadian audiences. And so basically all the work that we've done over the last 8 years, of sort of 12 productions that we've done, have been brand new to our audiences in one sense or the other. So if another company had done it in Toronto, or really anywhere in Canada before us, probably would have been less interested. I think part of the reason it hasn't been done, even though it's a script that is highly acclaimed, is it's massive. It's an epic 3-hour piece, 14-member cast, and many surprises embedded inside of it, and our company sort of developed a reputation for taking on these epic projects that, yeah, maybe other people are a little bit wary of for one reason or another.
For a non-musical, that is a substantially large cast for a theater production. I imagine casting and scheduling might have been a bit of a nightmare. How do you go sort of working out all the intricacies of a company this large?
Well, based on the nature of the play, we knew we really couldn't figure out much until we had found the man to play Johnny Rooster Byron. And actually, Philip Riccio, who's the co-producer, and myself, we've been talking about doing this for a couple of years. But really, we were it all really came together when we approached Kim Coates and asked him if he would come back to the stage after being off of it for 30 years and making quite a name for himself in film and TV, come back to theater to take on this role, because he was really the only person on the Canadian landscape we could think of who we thought would have it in him. And we were so thrilled that he was game, and when he said yes, and really it's been Phil, Kim, and I the last couple of years trying to figure out exactly how to make this project work. And along the way, we've we've added the other cast members, all of whom are incredibly skilled and talented and accomplished in their own rights. And yeah, it was a little bit, took a little bit of finessing with schedules, but also I think this project is really special. And so the people who are involved, everyone really has cleared their lives. And for the next 2 months or so, it's all about this.
You're co-producing the show with another theater company, and, you know, theater is collaborative by nature, but what are some of the unique challenges that might come about producing a show with another company, you know, who has their own sort of mandate of the type of shows they want to produce?
Well, I think you always want to make sure who you get in bed with. In this case, company theater are really close friends, personally and professionally, with our company. Phil Riccio, who runs Company Theater, he's an associate artist of Outside the March, and he actually was in one of our very first productions, Mr. Marmalade, in 2012. And we've sort of stayed in touch since then, and we share a similar aesthetic of the kind of plays that we're looking to produce. Actually, it's sort of a running joke that quite often either we'll produce a play that they were looking to get the rights to or vice versa. So when we had the rights to this one and we knew it was too big to do on our own and we were looking for collaborators, they seemed like the perfect people to go to. And what's also been interesting about it is each of our companies have different priorities. We're an immersive company. We mostly do site-specific work. This play will be in a traditional theater, but staged in quite an untraditional way. And company theater is very actor-focused and really puts acting pedagogy and unique ways of getting work out of actors at the center of their work. And so this production is very much a hybrid of those two things, and I think it's the perfect play to do that with.
In terms of casting and the characters, how much do you work with Kim on the role of Johnny? Because he's a very different actor than somebody, say, like Mark Rylance, who originated the role.
I mean, I think in terms of casting, I'm just always looking for someone who I know has the character in them somewhere. And that could be, you know, an outward thing or an inward thing. And with Kim, it's a little bit of everything. I mean, within 5 minutes of meeting Kim, I knew that he was Rooster Byron, and he actually, I think, is much closer to the guy than Rylance. I mean, Rylance is one of our most gifted stage and now film actors, and he's very much a chameleon. And so even though he's not anything like the guy off stage, he was able to grow into the role, and he actually developed the play originally with the playwright. But Kim's case, I think he is much closer to who the guy actually is, and so that means we're able to really work from a bedrock place of what Kim brings to the stage, and then but that being said, obviously there's still quite a journey for him to go on to find the depth and the mythology of who this guy is, and that's been fascinating every day. Kim's done an incredible amount of preparation. He's flown 4 times to the town of Pewsey, where the play's based on, and met the locals there, met a lot of the people who the characters are based on, and really soaked up the culture. So it's really been at least a year's worth of work for between Kim, myself, and Phil, prepping for the play in every sense before the first day of rehearsal.
You know, this is heralded as Kim's return to the stage after 30 years. Did he was he able to just slide right into it, or is there a certain amount of maybe retraining your body to go back in this medium after all those years?
I mean, I don't think anyone ever really slides back into it, no matter how long it's been since they've done a show. I mean, I think it's an incremental process. And I mean, Kim, what's fascinating about him is that though he hasn't been on stage for almost 30 years, before that he had quite a distinguished stage career, and he played Macbeth at Stratford and Stanley Kowalski and Streetcar Named Desire on Broadway. And so he has a wealth of theater experience, but it's buried deep within, 7 years on Sons of Anarchy and all of the other film and TV work that he's done. And so watching those flashbulbs go off, watching him rediscover the power of the stage and what he loves about the stage, that's been one of the real joys of the process. And it's quite a, in terms of the people we've got in the room, it's quite a hybrid. We've got a couple other actors who've done quite a lot of film and TV, Nick Campbell, Daniel Cash. We've got some real stage vets like Diana Donnelly, Phil Riccio himself, and some young and a number of younger actors. Peter Fernandez, who's done quite a lot of work at Soulpepper, among other places. Crystal Graham, Shakira Dixon, people who are just sort of making a name for themselves in the community. So it's really, I love to bring together ensembles where you can have that kind of cross-generational mentorship.
There are a few young characters in the play. There's a couple of teenagers, and then there's Johnny's young son. And I know, especially in the film and TV world, they always say, working with or acting with kids can pose unique challenges. What has the process been like for you directing people of that age, especially in the context of this show?
Well, they start next week, so I'll have to do part two of this. But I mean, we did go through the auditions and finding the young boys. They have there's going to be two young boys doing it in rep. So yeah, I mean, I auditioning for those parts was lots of fun because I got to meet a very different demographic of actors, and I don't want to say too much, but the place that the young boy occupies in the play is pretty special. And I think I've done some work at Stratford, and one of the things I love about working there and the canon of shows that they do is that Shakespeare really shows an entire span of life on stage. So you'll have kids, you'll have people in their later years, and everything in between. And it's a joy to work on a play like that, a contemporary epic where we have a 5-year-old, you've got the professor who's in the upper years and everything in between.
What was it initially about this particular show and the work of Jez Butterworth that you wanted to interpret?
I've wanted to direct this play for a long time. I used to work at Theatre Books when Theatre Books still existed. It was fantastic. Theatre and Arts bookstore in Toronto, and it was a great place to work in my early 20s. I read so many plays and met so many people in the community. I vividly remember on one of my first shifts scanning through the shelves looking for something to read, being so struck by the cover of this published play, picture of Rooster drinking some gunk out of a pint glass, just looking like a god. And it's a 3-hour show. I sat behind the counter for 3 hours just transfixed by his language, by Jez Butterworth's language. It really does have the soul of a classical play, but in a contemporary container, and that's really rare, really hard to find, especially in Canadian theater. Because of budgetary restrictions and other things, I find that the canvas that we think on is often really contracted. It tends to be a 90-minute, one-act, 3 or 4-character play. So to get to work on this 3-act, epic, 14-character piece is something I knew I wanted to bring to the stage. It doesn't happen overnight. You need to assemble a lot of pieces to do something like that. But I couldn't be happier with how it's coming along. I also directed a reading of this play at the Shaw Festival in 2013, and even just that was just with 6 hours of rehearsal, so almost no rehearsal and no staging. We're just reading it, and to watch how it held the audience's attention and the spell it cast on people, I just knew I had to put it on stage at some point.
Given that you're directing somebody else's words, how much leeway are you allowed in terms of interpretation? Because I know somebody like Beckett or Williams, you basically have to stick to the script word perfect. How much are you loud in terms of maybe change one word here or one word there?
I think you always want to stick, if it's a good play, you always want to stick to the script. I mean, it's the script that probably made you fall in love with it in the first place. So, I mean, we are religiously following Butterworth's text. I think where some of the controversy with Beckett have come in is that beyond just the word perfectness of the text, the Beckett estate is notoriously stringent for really clamping down on interpretation. You have to follow the stage directions to the letter and also the staging concept. And that tends to be less true with contemporary playwrights. I mean, you're quite able to bring whatever concept you want to it. But with a play like this, the script is giving you such clear images. I wouldn't want to stray too far away from the playwright's intentions, because then I would just direct a different show. I think this play offers such a clear and specific roadmap. We're certainly bringing our own interpretations to it. And also trying to update it, have it take place in 2018. It was written about 10 years ago. Certainly some of the themes of the play in terms of local communities versus forces of globalization feel really taught after something like Brexit. And so I think the play is only more interesting to setting it in 2018 and looking at in the wake of something like that. But I would say the playwright is absolutely a silent collaborator in the process. We're working together, and his text is really, really setting out the blueprint for what we're going to do.
With everything that's happening in the world these days, how has theater managed to remain relevant and culturally aware in ways other mediums like film or TV aren't?
Something I think about a lot, because certainly theater has a little bit more of a niche audience than what a feature film might be able to reach. When we so so as I said before, we call ourselves an immersive company, and to me what that means is we're looking to form a deeper relationship with our audience and really allow our audience to disappear into a world that can fully consume them and hold their attention for however long they're in there. I think that as we spend more time looking at screens, disappearing onto the internet, less time having face-to-face communication, we're all hungry for live experience. I actually think there's never been a better time to create theater because of all of the other forces and demands in our time, because theater can really offer a respite from the detachment of being online, of watching Netflix at home, to actually leave your house and have a communal experience with a group of audience watching something that will only happen that one time. So especially work that is more experiential, the work that we tend to do, we tend to use the word experiences rather than plays for the work that we do. It feels like, it feels essential at this moment, I would say.
And you told me earlier that within your show, the first row in the audience is sort of almost part of this show. How do you know that's gonna, you know, how do you sort of, you know, anticipate for the different audiences each night when they're a part of what you're putting on?
So we've done something with the front row of the audience that we're referring to as our Rooster's Rats squat seating, and those are tickets that we're selling at a discounted rate to arts workers and people under 30. They'll probably be the best seats in the house, I think, really ringside, but they're embedded into the set, so you'll be sitting in old couches, lawn chairs, car seats, things like that. I mean, they're not part of the play in the sense that, like, there's no interactivity with the audience, but you really will feel like you're just on the edges of the world and part of the aesthetic of the piece. We're also inviting everyone who has a ticket to the show to if evening performances start at 7:30, but we're inviting people to join us in the theater as of 7 o'clock to participate in a forest rave. This whole play takes place the morning after a debaucherous party, and we really wanted to give the audience an experience not just of the hangover but of the festivities as well. So there's a bar embedded into our set in the hood of an old car. You can come and buy and have a drink with the characters, and really experience what the revelries in Rooster's Wood is like, because it's a key theme of the play is why this sanctuary needs to be protected, and we want to give people a visceral sense of exactly what happens here.
I just forgot what I was going to say. Sorry.
Okay.
In terms of, you know, the theater scene in Toronto right now, you know, it obviously it's been in the news recently, but I think there's also a lot of companies that are doing really, really good work. What do you make of the status of theater in the city right now?
I mean, it's a pretty broad question, because I think there's such a broad landscape of the work going on that as much as it's a communal and collaborative industry, there's also, it's a range that holds everything from huge budget blockbuster musicals to a one-man show going on at a storefront theater, to work that doesn't even happen in traditional theater spaces, which is a lot of the work that we do, to everything else. So, I mean, I think it's a vibrant community because of the diversity of the work that's being put on. I always think that because theater it is attended by a relatively smaller niche audience, that the potential for it to grow is enormous. So we're always creating work looking to attract people who don't consider themselves theater goers, who don't normally go to the theater. And we invested in a large subway ad campaign, which is challenging as a non-profit theater, but we felt like it was really important to get the word out about this production to people of all walks of experience, not just your average theater subscribers, because I think if we can get them in there, they'll find something unexpected and memorable in this piece.
You're 2.5 weeks from opening. In terms of the process of rehearsal, what is this last period like in terms of, you know, the last little bits of the coming together? Is there a lot of maybe like, oh no, we have to do this. Oh no, we have to do this. Oh no, we have to do this.
I mean, it's a big part of my job to try to navigate the ship, so it's not quite as scattershot as that, but sure, honestly, I think most of the work happens the week before opening. In terms of the first couple weeks of rehearsal are really just about starting to figure out what this play is. You know, people are getting the lines in their head. You're sort of figuring out the space, the character relationships. And once you've done all that work, then you can really start to play. And then you can actually really start to figure out what's at the core of the piece you're putting on. So I always find that you make the most core fundamental discoveries in those days before you move into the theater.
Well, Jerusalem previews on 13th and 14th of February and goes up on the 15th, and it runs until March 10th at the new Crow's Theater on 385 Carlaw, I believe it is. Mitchell Cushman, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Dan.
That was theater director Mitchell Cushman. This is Danielle Duval's song, Whenever You Want It. That was Whenever You Want It by Danielle Duval off her album Lose It. She really recently had her album launch party at the Horseshoe on Friday as part of that venue's Class of 2018 musical concert, which featured other great bands such as Moscow Apartment, who will probably be on the show in February, and Lost Cousins. She's originally from Montreal, but she now calls Toronto home. I spoke with Danielle before the show about recording Lose It and also what it was like to collaborate with her cousin, Sam Roberts. Here is me and Danielle Duval. Danielle Duval, hello.
Hi.
How's it going tonight?
Good. It's just so, it's Duval.
Oh, Duval.
Everyone always gets it wrong, don't worry.
Right, because you're from Montreal, right? Yeah, so it'd be
so
the French.
Actual French name.
Duval. Does that annoy you at a certain point, or do you just sort of get used to the mispronunciations?
Well, it's a little bit annoying. I don't blame people. It's just a linguistical thing, but sure, it's nice to hear my name said right, that's all.
Danielle Duval, right?
There you go.
I should know, like, having some French. So this is sort of your album launch party, if you will, for Lose It. What's it like? Obviously, it's a big deal having an album released, but in a venue as iconic as the Horseshoe, what does that mean for an artist? Is that something you think about?
For sure, yeah. I mean, when the opportunity came up to have the launch party here, and the date was on the same date as of the actual technical release, so it was perfect, you know, and we get to share it with some great bands and some of whom I'm friends with, so it's gonna be a good night. It is a historical venue, and they just had their 70-year anniversary, so yeah, it's a good time to play at the Horseshoe.
So the album is called Lose It. Mm-hmm. This is your sophomore LP. How did the process for creating this album come about? When did you decide that the time was right to make that second one?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I got back from touring with Serena Ryder, which was a really amazing tour, it was one of my first major tours, and I got to be on the tour bus with them, and it was super fun, and it just felt super legit. all the venues, most of the shows were sold out across Canada, and it was in all the most beautiful theaters I'd ever seen in my life. And, you know, like, a lot of times when you're the opener, you know, people are still kind of filing in when, you know, not necessarily interested, and, you know, they're there for the main event or whatever. But by the time I was on stage, everyone was seated, you could hear a pin drop, and, you know, Serena's audience is a very listener-friendly audience. They're there because they love music, and so it was a real eye-opener for me, and it just, like, solidified for me that I want to do this for real for the rest of my life. And so, you know, it was, when I got back, I was like, I want to make the best record I could possibly make, and I'm going to do everything I can to make it as good as I can make it. And so I was on a very solid mission when I got back.
I think your music complements somebody like Serena very well, and I've seen a few of her shows. She seems just like a really fun person to be around. What was the touring experience with her like?
Well, I mean, she is, you know, she's also very professional and very serious. And, you know, when we first got on the tour bus, she had lost her voice, so she was taking very good care of herself. And again, I was like, oh, she's so serious and so, you know, this is so great. And she, again, like, I was singing for half an hour a night, and she was singing for like almost 2 hours a night, and I was like, I can't even imagine singing that long every night. But it was, you know, her and the people she surrounds herself with are great people, and so it was just a really fun time, you know, again, just being across in small towns across Canada, and you just really see how great our country is, and the whole environment was just great.
So the new single on it is Undercover off the album. The most recent music video, I believe, well, the one that I saw was for Undercover.
Yeah, that's the most recent music video. The new single is going to be Whenever You Want It, and we have a new video for that coming out shortly as well. So yeah, that's the latest single.
How the process for you of, or, you know, in collaboration with, you know, with your producer and the record label about deciding what songs or which songs are going to represent the album, if you will, what kind of discussion is that?
Well, the discussion with my record label was a very personal discussion because I am my own record label. People play records. So again, like one of the main things, one of the most important things for me when starting this record was who do I want to produce this record? And so I asked a lot of friends, some in the music industry, some not in the music industry, and all of those friends pointed to one person, totally independent of each other, and that was Gus Van Gogh. He's also a fellow Montrealer, and the first time we met was like, it was match made in heaven already. It was just immediate, you know, an immediate friendship. And he's an amazing producer who's worked with lots of amazing artists. Canadian artists like Kells, Sam Roberts, Winter Sleep, White Horse. He's worked with some amazing bands. And so, and also he's just got great vibes, so it was really great to work with him.
Speaking of Sam Roberts, he appears on the album. You co-write a song with him.
Mm-hmm.
Was that Gus's doing? Did you have this idea and Gus was able to bring him on board? How did that collaboration come about?
Oh, that was through me because Sam Roberts and I actually grew up together.
Oh wow,
we're cousins. So you know, we grew up listening to the same music, and we grew up surrounded by, you know, our parents are South African, and we grew up around a lot of good South African music and a lot of good rock and roll, because both of our dads were really into rock and roll. Bob Dylan, the Beatles, Paul Simon, that was all playing in the house all the time. So, you know, I'd always sort of, in my past musical, we were in our first bands together in high school when we were 15, you know, in Montreal you can get into bars when you're 15, so we started playing shows at 15 together. But yeah, so for this record I was like, you know what, I think it would be great if we did something together, and we did. I've sung on a couple of his records, and but yeah, we did a bunch of stuff together on this one. It was time to call in all the troops for this record, so that was one of my calls.
Is there something different when you collaborate with somebody who's also a member of your family?
Well, I don't know, because I haven't really collaborated with many people who are with people. You know, when I write songs, I usually write by myself, because I don't know, the writing is a very personal thing for me, as it is for most artists. But yeah, to open that door, it takes a lot of trust, and for sure, I put a lot of trust in him, and you know, but he was probably harder on me than he would be on anyone else, but in the best of ways, because, you know, there's no point in sort of, you know, beating around the bush about things. It's important to be honest and brutally honest about when things are good and when things aren't working, and to be able to take that feedback and just learn from the process is very important. So, yeah, it was, I just had an open mind. I just had a very open mind, and I think that made things a lot better.
How would you describe your writing process? Do you find that your lyrics first, or is it always the music with the words and vocals added afterwards?
It's always different. It's different for every single song. Sometimes I'll write it together at the same time. Sometimes I'll write the lyrics first. Sometimes I'll write a melody will just come to my head, and I have like 1,000 different voice memos on my phone that every time an idea comes, I'll record it right away, because you never want to. It's easy to forget ideas after they come, and you never want to sort of miss that opportunity. So it's always different. I have a great little studio in my apartment. And I do a lot of work before I sort of open it up to other people, you know? So I do a lot of sort of brainstorming and trying out parts, and just do the bulk of the writing at home on my own before I open up the floodgates to anyone else.
The songs on this record have a lot of different mesh of sounds, and there's a little bit of electro, a little bit of synth, a little bit of pop. How much work do you do trying to find the the right tone, the right mix for each specific song?
Well, I'd say that part of things was very much Gus and his producing partner, Werner, because we did, I came with a lot of stuff recorded already on my own, and also, you know, did some recording with Sam as well, and then I have these two friends who are just insanely brilliant synthesizerists. I don't know what the word for that is, but they have their two brothers, twin brothers, Mark and Matt Thibodeau, and they've got like a crazy collection of original analog synthesizers and drum machines and samplers, and so we did a bunch of treatments on the songs, you know, with them, in terms of like just putting their synthesizers and their awesome gear on some of the songs, and so then I'd take, you know, started with Gus, then came back and did all the work I needed to do on it, and then went back to Gus, and he'd sort of find a place for everything, get rid of a lot of things, keep the things that were good, and, you know, he told me one day, he's like, I was terrified when you came that it would just all sound shitty, but it didn't, it sounded great, so... So I was pretty happy about that.
I know in the past you've released versions of your songs or albums in French. What does singing in French bring you? How is that different than performing the same song in English? Is it at all?
Yeah, well, we've only done once. Well, we did one for the song Baby Comes Night. We did a French version of that called Jour de Vienne. And it was interesting because I actually preferred the French version of the song. It just had an extra poeticism to it that the meaning of it became even more important to me somehow. There's a romanticism about the French language that's just so beautiful. And so, yeah, and we just did another one for the new single, Whenever You Want It, as well. So that turned out pretty awesome too. So yeah, I think, you know, my background is French, not from Montreal French, but from my South African father, who's also Mauritian, and which was a French colony, and then my mom's parents are Egyptian Lebanese, and they speak Moroccan French at home, and so the French culture is very important to me, and I think that sort of giving a voice to that part of me is important to me.
Do you think you'll ever do a full album in French in the future?
Yeah, I'd love to. Absolutely love to.
How did you... I know, I think it was on your first EP, you did a cover of the Grease song, You're the One That I Want. Mm-hmm. How did that end up on Californication?
Well, it was just one of those really special covers that came out of nowhere. I think, you know, the best covers are the ones that are very different from the original. And, you know, when I came up with it, I was like in the middle of a love triangle and I was in a really dark mood and I was just strumming these chords on the guitar and I was like, wait, this sounds like something, I'm not sure what it is, but, and then it clicked. I was like, this is like You're the One That I Want, that Grease song, that like really weird bubblegum pop song. How is this coming into my brain like this? And that's why I sort of Googled the lyrics, but I made sure not to listen to the original song because I didn't want it to shape my direction. And then a friend of mine, you know, a very dear friend of mine who also was plugging my songs to TV and film, like, just thought it was a great cover and it just resonated with a lot of people, so he was able to get it on Californication.
What in terms of creativity and artistry, what does covering a pre-existing song, what kind of fulfillment can that bring?
Well, that one in particular gave a lot of fulfillment to me because it's almost like, well, for me, it just gave a whole new meaning to, there's a desperation in it, and in those words, You're the One That I Want. And, you know, a lot of the lyrics are very clever. A lot of times songs that sound really poppy and really like fast paced and, you know, they sound like they're a happy song, like the lyrics can actually be very serious and heart-wrenching, and so that's, you know, put that twist on it, and it's, you know, that, like, one of my favorite covers of all time is Gary Jules' Mad World by Tears for Fears. The second I heard that when I was watching the movie Donnie Darko, I was like, who is that? What is happening right now? This is the best thing I've ever heard. And I think, you know, if you can do that with someone else's song, it's pretty cool.
You're sharing the stage with a very loud hip-hop group tonight, as we heard earlier. How, in terms of being on a bill with somebody else, like you mentioned Serena Ryder earlier, are you involved in that discussion at all, or, you know, does your people just say, okay, this is who we've, you know, this is who you're opening for, this is who we've booked you with?
Well, I was asked what I wanted to do, and I just, like, the idea of the date came up, and it being at the Horseshoe, and that was what was the deciding factor for me, and the fact that there's, like, a cool mix of different bands, Fleece, Lost Cousins, I think it's going to be a special night. It might be a very chaotic, crazy night, and it's probably just going to be great, you know, like, it's rock and roll. I think you have to have an open mind, and, you know, I've also toured with Royal Wood, whose music is very different than mine, but he's a very, like, sexy, sultry man, very talented man, and sharing the road with him was awesome, too, and, so I think it's important to just, like, keep an open mind and be able to share the stage with all kinds of people.
Do you have a favorite, either a favorite tour memory or one that sticks out for you for just being really kind of bizarre?
That's a good question. Like, on stage or off stage?
Either. Like, you know, maybe a moment on stage, or, you know, maybe a moment when you were, you know, in a hotel room somewhere, you know?
Well, I think when I toured with Royal Wood, it was my first time going across Canada in my entire life. And one of the deals was that I would share the drive-in. And I was like, I was so excited about driving through the Rocky Mountains, and it was my turn to drive while we were driving through the mountains. But for some reason, the magic of the mountains kept putting me to sleep. And I was like at the wheel and practically falling asleep every time we turned a bend. And then one day, like, we stopped and I was like, you're fired from driving. Because I just, like, I don't know what it was, but it was, that was very weird. But it was, driving through those Rockies was, you know, and, you know, there, in those moments you kind of pinch yourself. You're like, I'm working right now, and I'm like, just driving through the Rocky Mountains playing music, and also, like, Royal's really into wine and fine food, and so we always had, like, proper lunch breaks and proper food, and, like, one night we had this, like, amazing wine and roast dinner before one of our shows, and again, I just had to pinch myself. It's so awesome. And, like, being a musician in Canada is a great thing. It can be a challenging thing, but it's also a great thing.
What is your favorite song off of Lost It?
Lose It.
What's your favorite song?
I haven't quite lost it completely.
What is your favorite? I've lost it, clearly. What is your favorite song off of Lose It?
I have to say Subway Wall right now.
Okay.
Subway Wall is, they're all very special to me, obviously, but to singing, when I sing Subway Wall, I feel like I finally got to that place where I'm making the most of what my voice can do, and that song to me has a lot of emotion in it, and it's a very, you know, it's one of those moments that we've all had when you see someone, you know, like, across the room, but you don't have the guts to talk to them, and then you wonder why you didn't talk to them afterwards. Like, that's what that song's about. So it's a very clear message, and I just love playing that song.
Well, the album is Lose It. Not Lost It, but Lose It. And tonight is the big release party, so it will be out now, however people decide to purchase it. Danielle Duval, thanks so much for your time tonight.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Well, that was my conversation with Danielle Duval. Stay tuned for Friday's show, when I'll have Colin Mockery, Brad Sherwood, Mark DeBonis, and Trevor from the Arrogant Worms. We're going to take you out with the title track off Danielle Duval's Lose It. Thanks for tuning in, folks, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.